The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Ross, Judge Larkin, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding, calling case number A220864, Ryan Lynch appellant versus Condominiums of Buena Vista, Inc. respondent.
Good morning. Before you begin, I want to say a couple of things. First off, even though we're doing this argument remotely, the same rules apply. And we understand that from time to time, there may be interruptions. And whether it's a technical issue or some noise from something happening off screen, we'll do what we can to keep those at a minimum. And we will try to accommodate if there are technical problems to ensure that you have all the time to argue to which you're entitled. I only want to say one more thing, which is before you begin, if you would not just state your name, but also help us to pronounce it, if it's a difficult name to pronounce, and let us know if you or your client have any preferences that we should know about when referring to you. With that, are we prepared to proceed? The attorney, counsel for appellant.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you.
Go ahead.
May it please the court, Justice Erickson Lindell, for Appellant Ryan Lynch. Appellant Lynch is a member of the respondent, Condominiums of Buena Vista. He is a unit owner at the condominium. This appeal arises from Appellant's 2020 lawsuit regarding actions taken by the respondent's board of directors that violated the governing documents of the condominium. As the court is aware, prior to this current lawsuit, these parties were involved in a 2019 action where Mr. Lynch and two additional co-plaintiffs, who were also unit owners at the condominium, alleged that respondent entered into a contract with Widseth Smith Nolting Engineering, WSN, in violation of the condominium's governing documents. The complaint in the prior action centered on the fact that respondent's board allegedly entered into the WSN contract in 2018 without properly reviewing other bids, holding votes appropriately, and gaining approval from the majority of the members. The prior action was similar in nature to a derivative action, asserting claims for the board's alleged violations of the governing documents and other actions that allegedly harmed the community, the condominium community as a whole. Mr. Lynch and the other plaintiffs settled the prior action by entering into a mediated settlement agreement with the respondent. The effective date of the settlement agreement was February 7 of 2020. The settlement agreement included a release of claims arising from or related to the plaintiff's claims that were asserted or reasonably could have been asserted in the prior action, and a promise by the plaintiffs not to interfere with or delay WSN in the execution of its engineering services or repair recommendations under the WSN contract. The parties appointed Mark Healy as their binding arbitrator for any disputes arising regarding the terms of the settlement agreement. It is important that after the mediation, while the parties were finalizing the formal settlement agreement, Mr. Healy, in his role as arbitrator, clarified paragraph 9 of the settlement agreement, the term concerning the promise of the plaintiffs not to interfere with WSN. The arbitrator advised the parties that this language applies only to contracts in place as of the effective date of the settlement agreement. So the arbitrator made clear that the settlement agreement would not preclude the plaintiffs from asserting claims relating to any subsequent contracts or amendments by the condominium. Also, the settlement agreement did not include any release of future claims arising from future violations by respondent of the governing documents. And importantly—
if I can jump in on that, because I do think there are two separate questions. The first is whether or not the current lawsuit arises out of the settlement agreement terms. And then the second is interpreting this release language that the arbitrator does. So why don't we start with that first question? You just said that there was some language in the contract that was clear. It does not preclude a separate claim for a future violation? What is the section number that you're referring to?
So paragraph 5 of the settlement agreement, Your Honor, is the release by the plaintiffs. It does not release future claims.
Okay. But you would agree, though, that that there are sections, that it's not merely a settlement agreement resolving a claim, right? There are promises made in this agreement between the parties regarding future conduct.
I would agree that the respondent affirmatively, it affirmed its obligations under to abide by the governing documents, certainly. And the plaintiffs agreed that in the future, they would not interfere with WSN.
Absolutely. And you don't dispute, or you don't think we should change the case law that both the district court and respondent's brief include regarding the breadth of what it means to say arguably, or what it means to say arising from or arising out of? Do you think that that's still good law?
I think it is good law. I don't think we're looking for any change in the law, Your Honor. I think that we have a de novo review of for the first order submitting compelling the parties into arbitration. We've got de novo review of whether this claim that in 2020, the condominiums board violated the governing documents in connection with approving an assessment and some contracts in 2020.
Well, I mean, to the extent that we're looking at that broad language in previous case law about what arising out of or what it means to arise out of, wouldn't you also, under de novo review, we're looking at whether or not Section 3 was violated?
I think that the contract has to be, the settlement agreement has to be interpreted and applied to the facts of the case as a whole. So we have to harmonize the language here. So I think it's very important that when we're talking about arising out of, we are understanding it just doesn't make sense to say that when we're releasing in paragraph 5, okay, things that we know about or don't know about, we're talking about things that could be asserted as of right now today. That doesn't include something that happens a year later. It doesn't include something that happens 6 months later.
No, I understand your argument that the arbitrator misinterprets the release language. That's a separate question for me from whether or not the lawsuit arises out of the settlement agreement. Now, sure, there's some overlap, but to the extent that there's a promise in Section 3 that the association will follow governing documents in future proceedings, and the new lawsuit is that the association didn't follow governing documents in a future proceeding, it seems that under de novo review, we are asking whether or not the lawsuit is related to the promise in Section 3, or perhaps the promise in Section 9 that the homeowner will not interfere with the WSN, the services provided by WSN. So under either Section 3 or Section 9, it seems like that's the part I'm looking at when I'm asking about the breadth of the language in previous case law about arising under. So maybe you can address how the 2020 lawsuit is not so related to the promise made in Section 3 and the promise made in Section 9 that we can, under de novo review, say, agree with you on that point.
And I think, so thank you for clarifying that, Judge. I really want to be able to specifically speak to the issues that are going to lock in on what matters. With regard to Section 3, you have the condominium affirming its obligation under Minnesota law and under the condominium documents themselves to behave in a way that complies with the condominium's governing documents. So you have an agreement that says we're going to do these things. That's a one contract. You have the governing documents themselves. That's another independent, separate contract. And you also have Minnesota statutes that are on point that require the condominium to abide by these terms and conditions. So we have, multiple sources of this duty to abide by the condominium's governing documents. The arbitrability issues in the settlement agreement flow from paragraph 14 which appoints Mark Healy as the binding arbitrator in the event a dispute arises regarding the terms of this agreement. So that's clearly aimed at, if we don't agree as to what the settlement agreement means, Mark Healy is the arbitrator that determines this. He's the person that's going to tell us what the settlement agreement means. So that, I don't see any link between those two things. The condominium promising to abide in the future by its own documents, and in paragraph 3, and then in paragraph 14, if there's a dispute.
I mean, it seems like there's a dispute. Operated in a manner consistent with its governing documents. That's the heart of the second lawsuit. And that, to me, is a dispute over whether or not there's a violation of Section 3, just looking at the plain language of Section 3. Now, I agree, if Section 3 wasn't there, if there was no contractual promise from the association to operate in the future consistent with governing documents, then yeah, there could be very well an argument about whether this is a new lawsuit or something arising out of the settlement agreement. But the plain language of the settlement agreement seems to include this promise, separate from resolving the previous claim, a promise regarding future conduct.
I don't think that it's fair to say that the settlement agreement expresses that the plaintiff is forever giving up his right to bring a lawsuit for violations of the governing documents of the condominium in the future, and that he is accepting that arbitration is his sole remedy for any and all future violations of the governing documents of the condominium. If that was the intent of the parties in drafting this settlement agreement, it would be very easy to say so in one or two sentences, and it would not require a lengthy discussion, analysis, and sort of tortured forcing together of paragraphs 3 and 14 to say, well, here you said you were going to abide, and in 14 it talks about a dispute regarding the terms. Can I look at that as somehow saying all future violations are subject to arbitration? I think paragraph 14 is the common language that you see in mediated agreements that says, hey, if we disagree over the interpretation of this settlement agreement, we're not going to court, we're going to the arbitrator. It is not saying an alleged violation of this settlement agreement must be resolved in arbitration. It's talking about construction or interpretation of the agreement, not violations of the agreement.
And I would let's say there was a alleged violation regarding payment. Under the settlement agreement, there was a payment promise. If that doesn't happen, and there's a dispute about whether it has happened, you're arguing that that could be the basis of a brand new lawsuit despite this arbitration clause?
Absolutely. If the allegation was that the Buena Vista failed to pay the amounts called for under the settlement agreement, you would either bring a motion to enforce settlement agreement in the district court, or you could start a new lawsuit for breach of contract. And if Buena Vista said there is ambiguity in the settlement agreement with regard to this paragraph that says how much we're going to pay, it actually says we're going to pay $1,500, not $15,000. If there was some ambiguity or disagreement over what the settlement agreement means, or the amount that was supposed to be paid, that would go to Mark Healy as the arbitrator. But as to whether or not it was breached, no. I think that this is very clearly a Mark, we're not going to waste time and money arguing over whether or not we agree on what it says. Mark Healy's going to tell us what it says if we disagree. And frankly, I think that the record shows that that's correct, because that's exactly what Mr. Healy did when he clarified that paragraph 9 of the settlement agreement applies to contracts that are in place as of the date now. It does not apply to future contracts. And I'm close to being done with my time. I feel that clarification by Mr. Healy is very important, because A, the contract does not resolve future claims for future violations, which is what the 2020 lawsuit is all about. It is not about leaks. It is not about the leaks are somebody's fault and the leaks are, there's a cause of action for leaks. The cause of action is when we went to have a vote on approving contracts and assessments, you did the vote wrong. You violated Mr. Lynch's rights. You have to have the process. You got to follow it. That's what the lawsuit is. These violations, failure to follow the correct procedures, that happened in 2020, many months after the settlement agreement was signed. The argument is, well, it had to do with the leaks. Isn't the leaks what the first lawsuit was about? And the answer is no, it wasn't about leaks. It was about failure to follow procedures. We can't look at, well, we failed to follow procedures in 2018 and we settled that. Now that means we can fail to follow procedures forever and you're done. You've given up your right to hold us accountable for following the procedures. And that is why this requires reversal. The district court misinterpreted, misconstrued plain language of the settlement agreement and sending us to arbitration. And then Mr. Healy inexplicably reversed himself, completely misapplied his own theory of the case, his own prior determination, in saying that these claims for 2020 violations somehow, when he had already said new contracts aren't included in the settlement agreement, said now they are under the settlement agreement. So they've been released. They got to be dismissed. That should have been vacated. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you. My name is, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Janine Letcher, and I'm representing the respondent condominiums of Buena Vista in this matter. I submit to you, this court should affirm the district court's ruling both on initially determining that the claims by appellant were subject to arbitration, and then by refusing to vacate the arbitrator's order. When the district court held that appellant's claims against my client were subject to arbitration, it just merely reinforced what's long been the law in Minnesota. Arbitration agreements are construed broadly and in favor of arbitrating disputes, with the party opposing arbitration bearing the burden of establishing that the dispute's outside the arbitration clause. Here,
Ms. Letcher, if I can ask a question regarding the broad, I don't want to call it a presumption, but the way that arbitration is viewed favorably in the Churchill case, the holding is that, quote, any doubts regarding the scope of arbitration must be resolved in favor of arbitration. Do you think that means then that somebody who's trying to avoid arbitration or has to effectively show beyond a reasonable doubt, because Churchill says any doubts, that they have to show beyond a reasonable doubt that the, in this case, the 2020 lawsuit does not arise from Section 3 and Section 9? It's a pretty high standard. Or do you think that there's a lower standard despite that language in Churchill?
Well, and Your Honor, I will submit to you, it's a little bit shaky following the amendment of the Minnesota Arbitration Act in 2012. Obviously, Churchill did predate that. But I do believe it is a high standard. And that is because in Minnesota, contracts are construed according to their terms, settlements are favored, and parties are held to what they agree to. It is a high standard that when you agree to an arbitration clause, and in this case, the clause is quite broad. It's regarding disputes regarding the terms of the settlement agreement, not regarding the meaning of the terms of the settlement agreement. It's very, very broad. In this case, that high standard applies because appellant here is trying to challenge an agreement that appellant entered into with the help of counsel. And did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think you did. I mean, sort of. You said it is a high standard, but you didn't say whether you think it is beyond a reasonable doubt or what the standard is, however high it might be. And I don't want to try to put you on the spot, but I don't think the amendments to the Minnesota Arbitration Act changed that part of Churchill. And so the question is, how high is the standard here? And whether it's your position that Churchill means it's beyond any doubt.
I mean, the language that Churchill uses are, if there is any doubt, it's resolved in front of arbitration. I don't want to put words in a case that's not there anymore. And I agree with you. I don't think that it changed certain standards of the Minnesota Arbitration Act. That said, I think what happened was that some of the language that was previously used, reasonably debatable and things like that, maybe have thrown into effect, as I believe this court held 2 years ago. But that part aside, it is a high standard. Because they use the term, if there are any doubts, is resolved in favor of arbitration, I would say it's beyond a reasonable doubt. Following entering, in our view, properly arbitration and compelling the case to arbitration, when the district court subsequently held that there were no grounds to vacate the arbitration, it also properly applied Minnesota law, held that judicial review of arbitration award is exceedingly narrow. The court does not get to revisit what the arbitrator did. There are very limited grounds on which the court can step in, and it needs to be established by the person challenging the arbitration award, in this case, appellant. The court properly exercised narrow authority, held that the grounds were not established. And specifically in this case, the court held that arbitrator Healy did not exceed his authority and that he did not fail to apply his prior interpretation of the agreement. I just want to take that opportunity then to just sort of clarify again, there's a lot of arguments in the brief about whether the arbitrator's decision was erroneous, but again, we are limited to those limited grounds under the statute. And in these cases, the only two that have been raised are exceeding authority and failing to apply his own theory, and the district court properly withheld and restrained from agreeing to that.
Ms. Letcher, if I can ask another question regarding the differences, or if there are any, between the Minnesota Arbitration Act and the Federal Arbitration Act. I guess I start with the question of why doesn't the FAA preempt the Minnesota Arbitration Act in this case? I know that the parties haven't argued that. I don't know if they argued it below, but I am curious as to whether you think the law interpreting the FAA, is that persuasive, or is it more than that for us today?
The case law in Minnesota is clear. Courts do look to the guidance from the FAA, and similarly, federal courts do look to Minnesota law in this as well. In this case, this isn't an issue of interstate commerce or anything like that, and it was not raised in the lower court. It was not argued that there's a preemption here, and so the parties have based their arguments on Minnesota law and interpretation of the Minnesota Act.
So there's the Oxford case from the U.S. Supreme Court in which the court concluded that even a grave error by an arbitrator, as long as the arbitrator was arguably construing the contract, a grave error is not a basis to vacate. It goes on to say the potential for those mistakes is the price of agreeing to arbitration. As we've held before, we hold again, it is the arbitrator's construction of the contract that was bargained for, and courts have no business overruling the arbitrator because their interpretation of the contract is different from the arbitrator's. The arbitrator's construction holds, however good, bad, or ugly. So I guess that particular interpretation of the FAA, as broad as it is under Oxford, is that the same in Minnesota? Your argument was we give a lot of deference. This is, I think, almost saying it's unreviewable. So the change from the arbitrator's interpretation of paragraph 9 at one point in time to where it came out, maybe that's just good, bad, and ugly, and something that we assume the parties contracted for.
Well, and I would agree with that interpretation, Your Honor. I think that the distinction would be if somehow someone could establish that the arbitrator was wrong to the extent it satisfied or applied to one of the grounds to overturn an arbitrator's decision under the statute. So if the arbitrator was wrong such that he exceeded his authority, he did something he wasn't authorized to do, he analyzed a dispute not in front of him, or if, again, the arbitrator was wrong in the interpretation saying, in one sense, they said that they had to do this, and now I'm saying they had to do that. But unless it fits within those grounds, the fact that the arbitrator got it wrong in quote unquote somebody's viewpoint is not reason to overturn it. There has to be more. And I guess I was going to touch on my next part. There is a de novo review standard here that was talked about when appellant was arguing. And the de novo review is simply whether or not the court properly analyzed the document and whether the clause is broad enough to encompass the current dispute. And again, all doubts are resolved in favor of arbitration. In this case, I won't belabor the point that we've discussed because I feel like your questions earlier picked up on it, but the standard is whether or not the standard in paragraph 14 was met, which is that this is a dispute. The claims raised by appellant are disputes regarding the terms of the settlement agreement. As the court correctly picked up on, there is a term in the settlement agreement that requires respondent to comply with governing documents and law. There is a term that prevents appellant from interfering with not only the actual WSN contract, but also its repair recommendations encompassed within that contract.
On that point, do you think that that language then precludes the homeowner from bringing a new lawsuit? That any lawsuit, any litigation, okay, that might create some doubt as to, there might be some doubt there as to whether that is a delay tactic and therefore potentially a dispute regarding the term in Section 9. Do you think that that's what Section 9 and Section 14 working together mean, that the homeowner can't bring any lawsuit regarding repair?
No, I don't think that's what it means, Your Honor, and that we've discussed that at length, both with the district court and with the arbitrator. The issue here is the same challenges were made. The same repairs were being challenged. The same recommendations were being challenged. It's not that this was a whole new issue with different waterproofing, different buildings, problems with a window, perhaps. That's not what happened here. What we have here is a far narrower situation that doesn't require the court to determine whether or not the plaintiff can ever, or appellant can ever bring another lawsuit. What we have here is appellant challenging the exact same repairs he challenged in 2019 with his co-plaintiffs. The repair recommendations of WSN related to waterproofing. And it is clear from the WSN contract that was submitted and the proposal submitted along with it that WSN was never going to be doing the construction work. WSN was obligated to assist the Buena Vista in finding a contractor and working with the construction recommendations. So there was always going to be another contractor or construction manager hired. This claim, as appellant points out, relates to the discussion of hiring a construction manager. That is a recommendation of WSN, and it squarely fits within the recommendations by WSN encompassed in paragraph 9. But as you correctly pointed out, all of these sections need to be read together, and all of these are terms of the settlement agreement. They're not read in isolation. But it's very clear when you compare the settlement agreement to plaintiff's complaint in this action that all of the claims made relate to the terms of the settlement agreement. The first two counts either seek declaratory judgment that the plaintiff has violated MCIOWA or the governing documents. They seek breach of contract for those. Those two claims clearly are alleging a violation of Section 3. The next count, count 3, discusses a violation of MCIOWA again, Statute 515B.4-1141. This is the governing law, and it's alleged by plaintiff in his complaint, actually, paragraph 5, that this is the governing law. So count 3 encompasses the same things, relying on Section 3. Count 4, again, seeks a remedy under MCIOWA, relates to Section 3 of the settlement agreement. And Section 3 is not the only term. There's Section 9, as we've discussed. There's also Sections 4 and 5, which read together, show that the intent was to allow the association to move forward with its obligations to maintain the common areas and to give plaintiffs some redress and avoid the circumstance so that litigation did not continue. And plaintiffs did receive their redress. They got $15,000. In turn, they agreed to stop interfering with these particular repair recommendations. Again, not all future claims, but the ones related to and discussed in paragraph 9 of the settlement agreement. I guess I'd like to move ahead sort of to then the motion to vacate, unless the court has any other questions about the agreement to arbitrate. But again, the court properly restrained in not revisiting or reanalyzing what Arbitrator Healy did, and instead specifically analyzed whether Arbitrator Healy first exceeded his authority and two, inappropriately didn't apply his own theory. And prior to that, there was this argument that the court improperly treated the other argument raised in some context that there was still no agreement to arbitrate. There's an argument in appellant's brief on this that this was an improper decision by the district court. It's important to note that the district court was extremely thorough in her first memorandum compelling arbitration, where she explained why the arbitration agreement applied and why compelling arbitration was the appropriate remedy. Thereafter, no attempt was made to either seek reconsideration of that view either with the court or the arbitrator. Now, appellant again raised it in the motion to vacate, and the court noted that there was no additional argument or evidence. Everything that was in the second argument of the motion to vacate had been reasserted to the court the first time around. Because there was nothing new, the court stood by her prior analysis and again determined that there was an enforceable agreement to arbitrate that covered this dispute. I want to talk about the argument of inappropriately or inconclusively not applying his own theory. this, importantly, was not raised to Arbitrator Healy in the context of the arbitration. Arbitrator Healy is the only person who can tell us what his theory was. And this was not raised to him. Arbitrator Healy, you're saying now that the claims are dismissed, or you previously said that, that Section 9 only applied. So the best person to decide this dispute for us never weighed in, and therefore there's no evidence as to what his theory actually was. Now, the documents submitted in connection with the motion to vacate the subsequent order following the mediated settlement agreement and the email talk about this interpretation of paragraph 9. But again, that says simply that paragraph 9 alone is limited to the WSN contract and repair recommendations therein. And it is only Arbitrator Healy's analysis in a specific context of only Section 9. It says nothing about Sections 4 or 5 or 3, which all must be read together in accordance with Minnesota law. Those provisions, again, read together, clearly evince an intent to put the challenges to the repair recommendations regarding these water leaks and made by WSN behind the parties. Without that, and without any evidence that Arbitrator Healy did not somehow follow what he had previously said about paragraph 9, there is no evidence that he did not apply his prior theory. Plaintiff says he relied on that. What plaintiff should have done is adhere to the agreement that he entered into, which was to release his claims and to proceed with arbitration about disputes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lindo.
I was still muted. I apologize. I think there's two things that need to be addressed on rebuttal. I think they're discreet and pretty straightforward. There was no challenge ever to repairs or recommendations by WSN. This repeated line of argument that keeps showing up, it showed up all through the briefing in front of the district court, showed up in the briefing in front of the arbitrator. It frankly demonstrates the lack of substance of the argument. The prior action, the main thrust of the allegations there was when we voted on this Whitseth Smith Nolting, this WSN contract, you guys rushed it through. You didn't share information. We didn't vote on it correctly. We didn't follow the requirements of the governing documents. It's not a dispute over, were these good recommendations? Were they bad recommendations? Are these the right repairs? Are these the wrong repairs? Are these repairs necessary? None of that. It is a process. It is a, did we follow what the declaration requires in approving this contract and the costs associated with this contract? That's what the dispute was. So the idea that, what we did was we resolved all these disputes over whether these are the right repairs or the right recommendations, that's just nonsense. That's not what the dispute was. It's an unfair way to say it. It's not accurate. The reason that that argument is continually pushed is because that's the only way to tie the 2020 lawsuit back to the prior action, because it involves attempts to repair the same problem, this water leak issue. But the repairs aren't the subject matter of the complaint. The subject matter of the complaint is, hey, if the board wants to fix these repairs, and they put a proposal in front of the membership to vote on, the governing documents tell us we get a certain number of days to consider the proposal. The proposal has to have certain kinds of information in it that we can think about before we vote on it. And then when we vote on it, we're going to do it in a certain way. And the plaintiff, the appellant's allegation is they didn't do it right. Once again, they threw that out the window, rushed it through, and didn't follow the procedural requirements for properly approving an assessment and new contracts. the argument that the condominium, the respondent is offering is that Lynch forever threw out his right to require the condominium to follow its own governing documents when approving assessments. We're talking about, you know, multiple $100,000 contracts, so that individual unit owners are being assessed tens of thousands of dollars. And the argument is that the settlement agreement somehow says that he has forever abandoned his right to say to the condominium, hey, if we're going to vote on this, we got to do it right. That's not in the settlement agreement. The second part of this is this: there's no evidence of Mr. Healy misapplying his own theory. That's just not true. You've got Exhibit 2 and Exhibit 1 to the January 28, 2022 Lynch affidavit. And you've got Exhibit 2 is right on point. You go into the third and fourth pages of it, and Mr. Healy, acting as the arbitrator, when we're having a dispute over what is the meaning of the terms in the, you know, when we're disputing the terms, not whether or not somebody did what they're supposed to do under the settlement agreement, right? It's not a dispute over performance. It's a dispute over terms. What does it mean? He very clearly explains that one of the claims in the underlying case related to the board's authority to enter into the WSN contract. The settlement is intended to finally resolve this issue. But this is not going to restrict the plaintiff's rights with regard to any new WSN contracts or amendments. So he makes it very clear. What we're resolving is the issue that the vote was done wrong that time. We're not resolving whether the vote was done wrong future times. Thank you, Your Honors. I very much appreciate it.
Thank you both. The matter is taken under advisement. We'll issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe.